From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 39th installment of our ongoing conversation with Professor Luciana Bone about the history of the Soviet Union. We continue today, which we started last week, a conversation about the presentation, the secret presentation, as it's called, by former Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev and first Secretary of the Communist Party, more germanely, to the 20th Congress of the CPSU, which was delivered in February of 1956. And it was a turnaround in the official line of the Soviet Communist Party, which essentially took on the criticisms of Trotsky and others of the party up to that point, and made them almost their own dogma, where they turned on Stalin as the symbol of all of that had happened. So let's go through this. We had a lot of more to cover.
Yes. The secret report took place on the 25th of February, Khrushchev's secret report on the 25th of February of 1956. He spoke for 4 hours, and he didn't go all the way. Restrained the degeneration of the Soviet Union. He didn't ascribe it to 1917 and to the Bolsheviks, but only to the arbitrariness of Stalin's rule. So, in other words, he maintained the virginity of the revolution and ascribed what he called its degeneration only to the arbitrary rule of Stalin. So, to summarize, I mean, there was so much in this speech, and the important thing is to look number one at its influence on international communism and the parties, the Communist Party of the world, and then the long view on how it led to the final dissolution of the Soviet Union. And that's why it's important to look at this speech. I personally think it's the most important speech of the 20th century. Not a speech, but I mean it's content.
Right.
So because the accusation was not only against Stalin, but implicitly, well, and specifically against the policies of Marxism-Leninism that he had, that Stalin and the party had pursued from Lenin forward. So the gossipy part, what I call the gossipy part, that is the attack on Stalin, the person, said that Lenin's testament criticized Stalin, that that Stalin had not a collective approach to labor, that he had been unable to prepare for the defense of the country before the Second World War, that he had made a pastiche of foreign relations, mentioning Yugoslavia, the break between Yugoslavia, between Tito and Stalin in 1948. That he had been involved in the repression, in the mass repression and the terror against the Communist Party in the 1930s, and finally that he had promoted a cult of his own personality. Now, what I said, that these were the attacks on Stalin himself, but it was also an attack on the theoretical basis of the Soviet foreign policy, shall we call it. He said that the Cold War was over, that that peace was the ideal frame for relations with other countries, and that he was really launching a politics which was called Pacific coexistence, and this was 1956, and he's asking for a kind of parliamentary structure of socialism within the party, in other words, social democracy, and to diminish the power of the executive, and that because Khrushchev argued that Stalin's rule had become a personal rule, so he wanted political pluralism. This sounds an awful lot like Western attitudes. Anyway, the result, what happened in the 60s, 4 years after the 1956 speech, when, for example, the left took off again in the United States, mainly, towards the policies of racism, against the policies of racism, the civil rights struggle and the criticism of the war in Vietnam, the anti-Stalinist ideology was so diffused, so, entrenched within the minds of even the people who were considered themselves left, that few even thought, I remember, thought of contesting the anti-Stalinist ideology. Yes, the young people were attracted by the struggles against racism, against war and imperialism, and they were attracted by the ideas of Marx and Lenin and by socialism. But they tried to adapt their idea with the idea of this dominant anti-Stalinism. So this is why I think so many embraced Trotskyism, because this was an ideology, a socialist ideology, that could live quite peacefully with the anti-Stalinism of the dominant class. In other words, in the Trotsky revival in the United States and to a lesser extent in other places, didn't bother the anti-communist, because it was itself anti-communist in being anti-Stalinist. Others were attracted by the idea of a new left, and that was to be an ideology that embraced ideals of peace, of anti-racism, of participatory democracy, but rejected what they called the old ideologies of communism and of capitalism. In other words, these were the new left was somewhere in between. And all this created a political confusion, and people today don't know whether they're right or left. Even when the new left was protesting Vietnam, when they were protesting the war in Vietnam, when they were sympathizing with China and Cuba, they never questioned this narrative of anti-Stalinism. That was proposed in the secret report, and that was advanced by intellectuals like Hannah Arendt and others.
Yeah, on the contrary, they held themselves out as, quote unquote, democratic socialists, which, they held that name out in opposition to the Soviet Communist Party, and with it, obviously, symbolically, Stalin.
Yeah. So that, and one of the other things that happened is that when the Soviet Union began to dissolve at the end of the 1980s, many parties, many communist parties, including, well, I know the Italian party and apparently the American party, attributed the collapse to the residual effects of Stalinism. In right. other words, Stalin was the one who destroyed the Soviet Union.
Right.
Which
the bureaucratic model ossified. The country could not respond to modern times. It was too focused on heavy industrial development and not on consumer goods, and couldn't command the loyalty of the people. Blah, 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 blah. That was all of the thinking back then. Amazing, however, in the aftermath, they haven't quite put together that nimble little market-oriented socialism that was going to bring cooperatives to every business, consumer goods to every person, and socialism to the four corners of the world. That hasn't happened, has it?
Yeah, it is quite a different picture from the... And you know, the dissolution of the Soviet Union brought the state we're in today, which is a kind of continuous state of war. It was a counter-revolution.
That was exactly what we have today.
Sorry.
What we have today is exactly what the Soviet Party warned we would have, and what we have essentially is what we did have without what the Soviet Union was doing to mitigate it. That's in that runaway mad capitalism, unrestrained, you know, going for the jugular with no one to slow it down or stop its appetites from draining the blood of humanity. And it's actually brought us to the point that we're at now.
Yeah, and so that's why I claim that the 1956 speech, Secret Report by Khrushchev, was a decisive moment, the one that actually launched the counter revolution.
You saw it manifest right away in Poland and in Hungary in 1956.
That's right.
You know, that's right. You had the right. People don't understand the maneuverings behind the scenes during World War II and towards the end of World War II, and then immediately after the conquest of Germany, when the two spheres of influence were carved out of Europe, in essence, the history of each of those nation states, the role that they played in the development and or fostering of fascism in Europe and or Nazism, their relationship with the business elite in Germany and Italy that brought fascism to those areas. All of that stuff is not considered, nor is the existence of the classes that benefited from that in places like Poland, Hungary, Bulgaria, and other places. And so, as Stalin and the USSR takes a public relations hit from the Kremlin, you hear stirrings of the petty bourgeoisie and of the fascists, the former fascists, inside Hungary and Bulgaria and Poland, and you start to see activity representing nationalist uprisings against the Soviet occupation, which it was an occupation as a consequence of the spoils of World War II. And it was the United States essentially stirring up trouble on the other side of the dividing line between the spheres of influence so as to move in. And by golly gee willikers, that's exactly what happened almost immediately after they finally took down the USSR.
There is the restoration of kind of fascist sentiment and class war.
Yep.
That is the, I was about to speak in Italian. Far from the class war having ended, it just was sleeping.
That's right.
And Khrushchev gave it a poke, woke
That's
it
right.
up.
That's right.
Woke up the elements that had been marginalized in the Soviet Union. Now, the reason why Khrushchev's speech has such power is, you know, people like Robert Conquest and Medvedev books followed, and they claimed that, well, one of the things that actually sticks in the minds of people in the West is the so-called purges. And, you know, Khrushchev was accusing Stalin of being the sole executor of those repressions of the 1930s. But in fact, they were the result of decisions made by the Central Committee, and right. Khrushchev himself was a member of the Central Committee, and he was a general party secretary of the Ukrainian Communist Party, and he participated in the decision to exact. Well, to root out. What he calls the purges. What the purges were, what the repression was, it was not a result of the suspicious and paranoid character and the hunger for power by Stalin, but real menaces to socialism.
Right.
Which were posed by a series of diverse origins. For example, right. The Fifth Column, the saboteurs, right. The traitors, the political opposition, the incompetence and the careerism of some of the members of the party. Right. In the case of General Vlasov in World War II, who went over to the Germans, is instructive because he constituted the so-called Army of Liberation of Russia and was only one example of the type of menaces that Stalin and the Central Committee had to confront and contrast. So during the purges, it is admitted that the party committed errors and that it removed and punished many innocent people. But and these errors did cause terrible damages, but the some of the victims of these 600,000 imprisoned or charged people, many were rehabilitated and subsequently served in the army or in the party and were recognized. One of them was Rokossovsky.
Right. That's right.
I mean, General Marshal Soviet Union Rokossovsky, hero next to Zhukov of the liberation of the Soviet Union and then of Eastern Europe, along with, what's the other one? The three. Anyway, Rokossovsky had been arrested, never talked about it, and had the warmest relationship with Stalin. In fact, they were on first name, what you call it?
First name terms. Yeah, first name basis.
And they weren't so diffused, this persecution and disasters, as Khrushchev depicted them. Many of the responsible of the injustices, this is a large country. You had party secretary way back east who had so many of these responsible were brought to justice. The two chiefs of the security office, the NKVD the time, both Yezhov and Yagoda first, Yezhov second, were condemned and punished, and in fact were part of the conspiracy. Once the trials were over, Yezhov, head of the NKVD, conducted these arrests and these unjust practices. Practically, he admitted to raise the population against the Soviet government.
Right.
So, you know, the purges have to be seen as always within the context of the time. What the revolution had from the beginning is attack from outside and attack from inside. These were not imaginary enemies.
Right.
Yeah.
No, not, I mean, look, you begin with the October Revolution. You have the white armies of the you know, the royal loyalists, you know, the czar's successors, the royal family successors, the armies of half the empires in Europe and the United States, conducting war in, on the territory of the Soviet Union up until the 1920s, into the 1920s, a refusal by the United States and others to even recognize the Soviet government until Roosevelt became president. We're talking 1933, 1934, to even recognize the government. Overt and covert actions around the world to try to smother it in its cradle, as Churchill put it. So overt hostility to the Soviet government, overt and covert actions taken across the country, sabotage, murder, invasion, occupation, all kinds of things, that this was real. This is documented. There's maps that'll show you where the incidents took place. And as the pre-war terrain was being staked out in Europe, the, you know, in the interregnum between the two wars, one and two, as the, you know, the ground was being plowed and seeded for World War II, the West, the European allies, quote unquote, that's the, primarily the colonial powers in Europe, the UK, France, Spain, the whole lot of them, they were plotting affirmatively with Hitler to have Hitler destroy the Soviet Union. And the whole involvement of the United States in World War II, if you look at it both in Europe and in Asia, it's clear that the strategy was let these people all kill each other. Hopefully they'll suffocate the communists in Soviet Union and in China as they rise and destroy each other. We'll walk in and pick up the pieces. And that's pretty much what they did, although it took until the 1990s to finally achieve it fully.
That's right. Yes. The as you said, the West, the since 1917, and even after the 90s, they fomented regional conflicts. They fed the armament race. They constructed military alliances like NATO, and engaged in a ceaseless economic war, an economic, ideological, and psychological war against the Soviet Union, and we were the targets. I don't know how much the United States spent on the on trying to undermine the Soviet Union, but I think Gus Hall, who was the leader of the Communist Party in the United States at the time, estimated that the United States spent, I don't know, 5,000 billion, trillion, 5 trillion or something like that. So that the assertion by Khrushchev in 1956, arguing that the class war had been won, overcome, really was amounted to a betrayal, of Marxist Leninism
Well, actually, at a class betrayal. If you actually look at what actually happened,
Very well put.
That's exactly what happened. Is that these self-same people who call themselves communists, who moved to the, you know, the forefront of the management and operation of the parties and the state and the economies developed by working people, in the face of all of the things that were thrown at them, those very same people essentially dismantled it and handed over the raw materials to the class enemy on a global scale.
To the class that had undermine them.
Yep.
So, in effect, the reason why I consider Khrushchev a key factor in the situation we're now, which is a counter-revolution, his speech and his theoretical claims, a reversal of theoretical Marxism, undermine the basis of Soviet socialism.
That's right.
And they were attacks against Lenin and Marx, and they prepared the Soviet dissolution.
Yep.
I mean, I don't think it could have been achieved without the help of this faction of the Soviet Communist Party.
Absolutely.
A civil war and an invasion from the West in 1920 didn't crush it.
Nope.
All kinds of economic strictures didn't crush it.
Right.
World War II didn't crush
it. Right, the Nazi invasion and the Japanese invasion didn't crush it.
Didn't crush it, that's right. The only thing which was understood would destroy the Soviet Union was the destruction of the Communist Party.
Yep.
And that came from within.
Yep. And exactly what happened sequentially in the Soviet Union was that Gorbachev and the Central Committee, his Central Committee, decided to allow the leading role of the Communist Party to be in the operation of Soviet society to be surrendered, and within a year of the Soviet Communist Party surrendering its leading role in the society, the country was dissolved. The nation state fell apart.
Against the will of the people.
Against the mandate at the poll, a referendum that said we want to stay together was ignored, negated, and the country was dissolved.
That's right. The referendum took place in March and the dissolution in December, secretly by four republics.
Yep.
Overcoming, I think the referendum was 78% in favor of the Soviet Union, and it was highest, the number percentage in favor of keeping the Soviet Union was highest in the East.
Yep.
You know, in the 90s. They wanted to keep the Soviet Union. So,
yep.
And how could Gorbachev, so Khrushchev spoke in 56. Then we have the 80s and Gorbachev. So even after Khrushchev was removed from power and substituted by Brezhnev, there was never any change of this de-Stalinization. That means that people, that students and young people for 30 years, just like in the West, in the Soviet Union, were instructed on de-Stalinization, were instructed on this myth that Stalin had degenerated, distorted the revolution. So for 30 years after the removal of Khrushchev in 64, the Soviets had this as a basic historical fact that Stalin had destroyed the Marxist, the Stalin was a monster.
Right.
So,
yep.
And then because the Soviet Union had such an authority in the world, the greatest part of the Communist Party of the world joined the chorus.
Yep.
Which obviously was in harmony with the ideological song promoted by the West.
Well, it was in harmony because it was being conducted. Let's face it, this was not an improvisational piece. This was rehearsed. It was scored, rehearsed, and perfectly executed. And it was a project, by the way, that commanded the largest budget of any human project in human history up to that point. We're going to stop here, and we could pick up on this exact point next week, start probing really deeply the operational aspects of this. And Luciana, again, thank you very much. I'm really enjoying this series.
Thank you, Don. My pleasure.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.